In a 1987 essay, Terry McMillan wrote, "Most of my girlfriends happen to be black, smart, ambitious, idealistic, over the age of 30, and professional. The silver thread that binds us is one that sometimes causes us embarrassment. We don't have a husband or a steady man in our lives, though most of us would like to." Her new novel, Disappearing Acts, is about a romance between a woman and a man who are so different from each other, they each feel they are sacrificing parts of their identities to keep the relationship together. Disappearing Acts is written in the alternating voices of the two main characters. Zora is a young teacher with ambitions to be a singer and songwriter. Franklin is a high school dropout who used to have a drug problem. He's a construction worker, but is often laid off. I asked Terry McMillan what she most wanted to understand about Franklin through finding and writing in his voice.
I think I wanted to understand his anger, his hurt, his sense of rage, and also his sense of disappointment in himself because he made some bad decisions, and as a result, he's suffering from them. And But I was trying to also understand how you deal with that. I wanted to get closer to his sense of helplessness. At the same time, he puts on this facade, you know, that he basically has it all together, that he is a super confident man. But underneath, he's not. He's pretty frightened.
Did you have a person to pattern his voice after?
Well, yes and no. He's sort of a culmination of a lot of voices. My brother, my ex, A lot of men that I've known over the years, and I sort of combined all of them. The ones that I think are not so much losers, but men who are pretty dissatisfied with the quality of their lives, and there's a similarity in the tone that I hear a lot of.
Mm-hmm. I want you to compare the two voices that you've written in, the voice of the main female character, Zora, and the main male character, Franklin. And this is deeper into the book. After they've had a baby, they're not married, and their relationship is really on the skids. She's supporting both of them. He's been laid off. He's been drinking a lot. And she's just bought him some... she just helped him start to do some woodworking in the house.
Mm-hmm.
The two excerpts I'm going to ask you to read is about picking the baby up from the daycare center. And the first excerpt is in Zora's voice.
Okay. "When I walked in from work the next day, Franklin was hard at work. 'Where's Jeremiah?' I asked. 'Oh, shit. I knew it was something else I was supposed to do. Baby, I'll go get him right now.' 'He forgot?' 'Never mind,' I said. 'Never mind. I'll get him tomorrow. I promise. I was just so into this, I got lost, baby. I got to change my measurements again. I'm sorry.'"
That was a chapter in Zora's voice, and part of that is a conversation with Franklin. Let me ask you to describe the same incident from Franklin's perspective.
Okay. Zora didn't even try to understand why I didn't want to pick Jeremiah up from the babysitter. She didn't have no idea how embarrassing that shit would have been for me. So I used waiting for a phone call on my woodworking as an excuse, but that wasn't it. I couldn't stand the thought that all the people in that house knew I wasn't working, knew it was Zora paying her, and I didn't want to be looked at and see the question in her eyes like, 'What do you do all day?' 'What I do all day is drink and stare at the walls and listen to music.'"
So when you were writing Disappearing Acts, your new novel,
mm-hmm.
did you find yourself believing more in either of the two characters? Because you had to create both of them. You had to put your heart and soul into making both of them.
Initially, when I wrote this book, I was a little angry, and I think I didn't have as much compassion for Franklin. And the second time, third time around, the more I got into him, the more I did develop a lot more empathy for him, because I sort of started to understand what it was like not to be able to bring home the bacon and have a woman who was proud of you. As a woman who has been in a situation like this myself, I know what it's like from a woman's point of view, but I was more interested in exploring the male character's point of view, especially being a black man, and the fact that this guy tried, and what happens when you keep trying and you keep trying and nothing happens, and how you get worn out. So I think I came to understand that.
So do you buy his argument that he gives, for instance, in the excerpt that you just read, that he didn't want to pick up the baby at the babysitter because it would have been too embarrassing to let everybody know that he didn't have a job and that Zora was actually supporting him?
I think I buy it, but, you know, sometimes when things get rough, people use everything as an excuse for not doing things. And I think this is just one more excuse that Franklin uses, even though for him it was probably valid. You know, I mean, that's part of what this whole thing is about. A lot of times we don't understand what it's like being in someone else's shoes. You know, all Zora was thinking about was that he did not pick the kid up from the babysitter and that here's one more thing she has to do.
The title of Disappearing Acts, in a way, refers to how sometimes part of your identity can disappear when you fall in love with someone who makes certain demands of you, you know. What kinds of things do you feel like you've sacrificed in relationships that led you to these conclusions? You know, parts of yourself that you found disappearing.
You mean personally?
Yeah.
Whoa. You know, I've always, I guess, been somewhat of a quote-unquote nurturer. And, you know, I've always been a believer and pretty too idealistic in a sense. And, you know, I think I've given up a lot of myself in order to help some men that I've dealt with in a romantic fashion to let them know that I believed in them. But the bottom line is that what I ended up finding out was that a lot of them didn't believe in themselves. And that's when I got drained, and I just said, later for this, I'm out of here. And it's happened to me a number of times. I mean, I'm 37 now. You know, all these men were, like, brilliant in their own terms. You know, had all these talents, from filmmakers to sculptors to photographers. I mean, all kinds of things. And they didn't have the faith in themselves that they displayed so vehemently in the beginning, and I always ended up getting disappointed, and I was sick of it. So I'm like, I've had it. I mean, I'm not giving up on men, but the ones with the potential, I'm not into it anymore. I went through that in college.
When you say you're giving up on the men with potential, you mean giving up on thinking that somehow you'd be capable of helping them bring out that potential and getting them out of that rut of a failure and disappointment that they'd been in.
You got it. I mean, at 35 or 40 years old, if they don't already have a positive and, you know, a really good sense of who they are and what they're about, and if their values aren't intact and stuff, I don't want to be bothered. I'm sorry. I just can't handle it anymore. I have a 5-year-old son, and any man that comes into my life is going to have to be a role model. And plus, you know, I would like to be able to lean my head on someone's shoulder for a change instead of always having them lay theirs on mine. I mean, I can barely walk straight now.
You know, in your novel, as Franklin's confidence falls, he starts to get abusive and starts hitting Zora.
Well, he slaps her once.
You said the novel was very autobiographical, and I was wondering if you knew what it felt like to be hit by a man and suddenly realize maybe this person isn't the person you thought. Maybe there's a side of him that you really didn't know, a side you don't want to get to know.
Well, I got slapped once, and I mean, I was shocked. I really couldn't believe it. But I whopped him back in the mouth and made his mouth bleed. He was shocked too. And then we sort of both just looked at each other. And, you know, I mean, I grew up seeing a lot of violence, not only in my household, but a whole lot of households. And I always knew that when I grew up, you know, any man that put his hands on me, that was it. He was history. And I told this man, you know, I'm not going to be one of these kind of women that you can, if you think you can do it now, you're going to continue. And, you know, today it's a smack, next time it's your fist. If this is the only way that you can handle your anger, I don't need to be around you.
Mm-hmm. Tell me how you first got published.
Ishmael Reed published a story. He was teaching at Berkeley at the time, and he, you know, I took this one workshop from him, and he told me that I had talent and that I could write. And I wrote this story that he ended up publishing in this literary quarterly that he was editing. And then there were, like, years later, I just continued to write because I never dreamed in a million years that I would one day be a quote-unquote writer. And it was nothing that I really aspired to. I just couldn't stop doing it. And then I won this fellowship for this story that I had started called Mama Take Another Step that ended up, thanks to the Harlem Writers Guild, becoming a novel. And sent it to Houghton Mifflin because I had this baby and I was 3 months behind in my rent and nothing was happening. And I said, what the hell? And it was for this fellowship, so I mailed it, and they published it, to make a long story short.
I have one last question for you, and we only have about a minute left.
Okay.
The characters in your novel always watch Wheel of Fortune and mentally play along and figure out what it is that they've won. Weren't you actually a contestant on Wheel of Fortune?
Yes, I was.
How'd you get on?
Hey, let me tell you, it was crazy. I was visiting L.A. when my son Solomon was his. He was just turning one. And when I was breastfeeding, I used to watch Wheel of Fortune every day. That was the time I fed him. And, I mean, I won so many cars and trips and stuff. And I said, when I was going out there, I told my sister to call. And I went through this battery of tests, which were hard. And I got on, and I won a set of encyclopedias. That's what I picked out, because as a child, we never could afford them. And I got them. So it was a fantasy.
Well, Terry McMillan, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.